Welcome to Net Front Presence. I'm Matt DeFrance of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, joined by Nathan Mills, also of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, to talk about the Blues and an odd week, I would say. They won a couple games. They beat Edmonton on Monday. They beat Buffalo on Thursday night. Mixed in there is potentially the worst loss of the season on Wednesday in Washington, a 6-1 loss to the Capitals. All in all, you know, they exit the week kind of with mixed feelings. Nathan, what's your take on the Blues this past week?
Yeah, so, you know, the game against Edmonton, I thought was, you know, the first period was a little rough. But then after that, I thought those second two periods were probably the best two periods of hockey I've seen them play all season. Thought, oh, here we go. Here's the turnaround, right? And then they go to Washington and nope. No turnaround. I think it's a really, this week has been a really good kind of microcosm, just a really good example of what, you know, how unstable the Blues have been this season, kind of top to bottom.
Yeah. And that Edmonton game, you kind of had the feeling of, oh my goodness, here we go again. They come into the game, they've lost 7 in a row, they fall behind 2-0. It seems like another one of those games where the bounces aren't going their way. Edmonton's getting a bounce here or there. I mean, it just didn't seem like it was, it seemed like it was a continuation. They're going to lose their eighth game in a row. It's going to be the same old story that maybe they play better than the opposition, but there's another L in the standings. And at that point, you know, I'm not sure how much the process matters when you lose 8 in a row. I mean, obviously, yeah. In the grand scheme of things, you hope that the process matches the results. And that's one of the things that makes Jim Montgomery a process-oriented coach. But when you're in it and when you're seeing it day to day, you see them lose 7 in a row, you see them down 2-0 to the 2-time defending Western Conference champions, and you're like, well, it doesn't matter how well they look on the ice. It doesn't matter how good they look. It's just about getting that W and, you know, good for the Blues and showing some resiliency. They got Robert Thomas back for that Edmonton game. Dalibor Dvorsky, we're going to talk about him a little bit later. He scores his first NHL goal and they get a big win. But after that, that Washington game just seems like it came out of nowhere.
Yeah, that was ugly. I didn't get to watch the game because it's on TNT and I don't have TNT, so I got to get the Post-Dispatch to get me a subscription to that bad boy. But I watched the highlights after, and even in the highlights, man, they looked lost. I mean, it looked like they weren't prepared at all. They looked slow. They looked sluggish. I mean, it looked like a completely different team on the ice from what we saw in Edmonton, at least in the second two periods, and that has. You know, I love Jim Montgomery. I think he's a great coach, but it concerns me that it feels like they're constantly not prepared. And it kind of seems like that's a trend here, or maybe not prepared, but maybe it's confidence. I don't know, but there's clearly something missing here.
Yeah. And you know what? I don't put all of it on the coach. In terms of preparedness, I think These are grown men. These are professional athletes. This is their job. Like, if you or I aren't prepared to do our job, is it our boss's fault that we don't come prepared?
Listen, I'm going to blame my boss.
I feel like it's the person themselves. They got to take some responsibility in what they do. And so, yes, I mean, obviously you'd like the coach to have them prepared. And I think to a certain extent, they do that every game in terms of,
yeah,
going over the scouting report, going over the game plan, how they want to execute, what they want to do, what areas of weakness the other team has. I feel like that's every game they go through that. So it's not like, you know, one of these games they go through it and one of these games they don't. Sure. And like, it feels like, you know, the coaching staff does their job, and at a certain point, it's the player's responsibility. And this is not a new thing, right? Like, we're talking about slow starts in games, but if we look at slow starts in seasons,
yeah,
the Blues haven't been an above 500 team in October since, I want to say, it was that 109 point season in 2021-22. You know, obviously 22-23 is when they had their 8-game losing streak, and that was an outright 8 regulation losses in a row. Like, that was a bad stretch. That happened in, you know, after they won 3 in a row. They won 3, lost 8, won 7. Like, that was an up and down season.
Yeah,
where that ended up in their first losing record in a long time. Obviously, in 23-24, the start of the season happens, and Fred Ruby's fired because of how it's going. The 24-25 season happens, and Drew Bannister is fired partially for how it's going, partially because Jim Montgomery became available. Right. And now we're going through it again, where the Blues, as we wake up this morning on Friday, are 5-8-2. They have 12 points, second fewest in the league. They're in 31st place in the NHL. A minus 18 goal difference, worst in the league. Like, they're not in a good spot. So it's not like these early season struggles are a new thing. It's happened under 3 different coaches. And if we want to even look at the players that have come and gone, a lot of them are different. You know, even from that 22-23 season, there's been a lot of turnover, I guess would be the word. But like, it's not the same up and down, back to front, completely the same group. There are obviously a lot of holdovers. I think we can always look at the Buchnevich, Thomas, Kyrou, Shen, Falk group. I'm looking at the roster from that year. Parayko, Torpchenko, like that's basically it. You know, Walker, Neighbors, like it's not a big group of holdovers from that roster a couple years ago when they first started being kind of a tough team to watch in October. So it's another tough start, and it does put them behind the eight ball again. If we do some quick math, right? Let's see, 95 points is around. Oh, I know you were told there was going to be no math, huh?
I know. You guys promised me no math. I'm going to have to break the calculator out. This is going to be terrible.
All right. So they have 12 points in 15 games. 95 points is generally the cutoff for a playoff spot. So that means the Blues would need 83 points in their remaining 67 games. And extrapolated across an 82 game season, that's a 102, let's call it. It's 101.6. So 102 point pace. Is this a team that can play at a 102 point pace for 67 games?
Today? Doesn't look like it. You know, you had a story this week
in the next 5 months.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, they don't feel like a 102 point team across an 82 game season, right? They definitely don't feel that way across what is now effectively a 67 game season, right? So you know, they need to get some things together quickly. The nice thing is this week, I think we saw some of that. We started to see the goaltenders start to bounce back some, although Binnington had a pretty rough night against Washington, but Hofer looked great this week. You know, we saw some changes in terms of how the lineup is handled, and that seems to have worked well, although granted that third game was against Buffalo, so it's not like they're beating cup contenders, right? But the short answer is no. I do not expect them to be 102 point, you know, pace team the rest of the way, and that's going to be really difficult. I think the talent's there to do it. I just, man, they're digging a hole.
So, Nathan, we have to talk about Jordan Kyrou, healthy scratched in Buffalo on Thursday night. Kind of a message sent from Jim Montgomery to the rest of his team. What did you make of the decision?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love most about Montgomery is his willingness to take a chance with the Stars. You know, he's not afraid to send a message, and clearly this was one, right? You know, I think we've seen a couple of guys get some wake-up calls, not necessarily through a healthy scratch, right, but through just something happens on the ice that has changed their play. I mean, we talked a little bit about how Hofer, it's starting to click for him again. I hope that this is the case for Kyrou here. You know, we've seen Montgomery do this before and it has felt like it's worked. But it definitely feels like, you know, at least from Montgomery's perspective, that there is something missing from Kyrou's game. And certainly though he scores a lot, you know, minus seven now or something like that on the season. So maybe there's something to that.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised, but I honestly have kind of liked Kyrie's game basically since the start of, or maybe not the start of last year, but maybe 2 months into the season last year. The start of it, there was some troubles with late game management. I think, I think some Blues fans will probably remember games against Utah at home or Philadelphia on the road where he was turning pucks over late in the third period of a tied game, and the Blues lose in regulation. They lose out on the point, which it looked like it might be something that cost them in the end. Obviously, it didn't. They still made the playoffs, but it was because of those struggles that later on, Drew Bannister didn't put him on the ice in a tie game late, actually in Buffalo. I remember it was in Buffalo where they kind of benched him at the end of the game. And I was thinking in my head, kind of all of the instances where Jordan Kyrou and the Blues, I don't know if butted heads is quite the right term, but where he's been put in a spotlight in a negative way. And I think we can go back to the end of Craig Berube's tenure in St. Louis. There was the one game they lost in overtime against Vancouver, I believe. And he comes out and says, our top players don't play with any passion. They don't play with any emotion. It was, he didn't mention any names, but I think a lot of us looked at guys like Jordan Kyrou and Robert Thomas as people he was talking about. That was a few years ago. And then the game before Craig Berube got fired. So, they lose to Detroit. It's an empty net situation. Jordan Kyrou turns the puck over all along the wall. Craig Berube says that can't happen. That just can't happen. That night, maybe an hour or two after he says that, Ruby's fired. Next day, a reporter asked Kyrou about Ruby. I don't know if it's necessarily 2 days after, but
Yeah.
he basically says no comment. He's not the coach anymore. And then he gets booed at home. He
Yeah.
scores. He has a tough game. He cries in front of reporters afterward. He comes back against Dallas the next game. He has a I believe it was 2 goals, perhaps the overtime winner, if my memory is correct. I don't know that for sure. And so those are the big ones. And then even more recently, he was part of, him and Thomas were scratched in the third period by Drew Bannister in Detroit. There's been, some chatter in the summer about whether the Blues would trade Kyrou. And when I talked to him in the preseason, he said, yeah, I mean, this was the first time I was actually a little bit nervous. I mean, he's been in trade rumors for a long time.
Yeah.
And now for him, he has control over his career, right? He has a no trade clause that is under effect until through the 29-30 season. So he's got all the control in what he wants to do in terms of accepting a trade. So, and then we get to this season and even right now, even after last night's game, we can look at where he is on the team. First in shot attempts, second in shots on goal, third in goals, and second in points. That's where he is in the team. And I think they're, from last season to now, there's been an effort to be a 200-foot player, to be a two-way player. There was a goal. He scored. I'm trying to remember who was. Oh, it was Dallas. It was a Dallas game. He caused a neutral zone turnover and led it the other way. Good zone entry. Held the puck down the wall. Fed it to Shen. Opened up in the middle of the ice. Got the puck. Faked the shot. Got some open ice in the inner slot and scored. Like that was a defense to offense play
Yeah.
that he's kind of made more often recently in his career. And so you add up all those things and you wonder, well, why was he the guy out, right? And I think the maybe not the writing was on the wall, but when there was a practice, I think it was about a week ago, that Jim Montgomery had maybe a 10-minute conversation afterward with Kyrou and Pavel Buchnevich. The three of them on the ice having a discussion, and it seemed like they were, demonstrating. I don't know whether it was positions or techniques, or they're talking through things on the ice and maybe what Montgomery wanted to see. And So like there has been a level of communication, a level of desire, I guess, from the coaching staff to want more from those types of guys. And then suddenly the 6-1 loss happens and it's Kyrie out of the lineup. So it's been, it's quite a history when you go through it all with Kyrie and the Blues and how he's kind of battled sometimes. And we'll see how he responds to this one. I mean, I know coaches generally don't like to change lineups after a win, but I feel like this is a situation where he comes back in on Saturday, and we'll see how he plays after that. I mean, Matthew Joseph was scratched on Wednesday in Washington and had a great game on Thursday in Buffalo. So
looked incredible last night.
Yeah, so there are different areas and different avenues for players to go after a healthy stretch.
I thought it was so interesting too, as it relates to, you know, Montgomery and Kyrou, that I think it was after the Washington game, you had a story where Montgomery said, "Hey, listen, I'm not going to single anybody out. I'm not going to single out players. I'm not going to single out coaches. I'm not going to single out myself. You know, this is a group effort and we all need to do better," which fair enough. But the very next game, it very definitely feels like somebody singled out whenever Kyrie's a healthy scratch, right? So I thought that it was interesting. I was surprised by it too, the same as you were. But I would really like to see, you know, coming out of this, I would like to see, you know, it creates some motivation for not just for Kyrie, for other guys, Thomas, Buchnevich, to your point. Even like Binnington, I know goalies are different than skaters, but like he's struggling too. And so seeing Hofer succeed in his place, whereas Kyrou seeing other skaters succeed in his place, I hope that that is the kind of thing that gets these guys going. And I kind of feels like that's Montgomery's hope, right? Too, is that like, here's an example of what happens when we're not doing what I'm asking you to do. You know, there's a lot of dynamics at play when it comes to something like that. And, you know, it's funny, you said that you would expect Kyrou right back in the lineup. And there's a part of me that thinks, and 3-0 against the Sabres. Like, I know it's the Sabres. It's not the Oilers, you know, by any stretch. But maybe it's worth trying it again. You know, I don't know. I don't know. Those dynamics can be tough to manage.
Sure, and I think maybe the other thing it accomplishes is it puts those other big names on notice, saying, you know, if Kyrie's coming back in, someone's got to come out. And I've scratched a big name before. Could it be me? So, I think maybe puts a little bit of that into guys. We'll see. We'll see how it all shakes out. You've talked about Joel Hofer a little bit. Want to get into him a little bit more. Great game last night. His best game of the season, I think, up there with that win in Calgary.
Yeah.
And it was his first win since that game against the Flames on October 11. He made 28 saves and a shutout. And really, in my mind, he was the biggest reason why the Blues won that game in Buffalo. So, I mean, what did you make of the way that he's kind of responded these last, I don't know, say 3 games? I think he has a 930 something save percentage.
Yeah, he's looked great. Looks more like himself, right? one of the things about Hofer is and a lot of goalies are like this, but Binnington and Hofer especially, they're confident, right? They want the net. Doesn't matter if I gave up 4 goals the night before, I want it again the next night. And he's stuck with it, and I think you're starting to see it now. There were a couple of things in that Sabres game. There was one goal in particular where it looked like the goal there, the puck hit him square in the chest, and he went to cover it and whiffed on it at first, and you know that almost created an opportunity for the Sabres to score a goal there, which of course they didn't. But I think we've seen a lot of that.
It was Rosen on rebound in the third period, right?
Yeah. And one of those situations where earlier in the season, teams were taking advantage of that and putting goals in behind him while he's scrambling for the puck. There was a lot of, you know, net front traffic for him. And this was a situation where you could see, it's almost like you could kind of see him processing quicker than he had processed earlier in the season. And when that puck hit him in the chest, it took him a second to find it, and then he dove on it. So that to me was an indicator of, you know, or it looked like an indicator that he's starting to come around. He's starting to, you know, feel it, you know, and I think that's part of it, right? You kind of just have to be in a groove. And hopefully that's the case for him here. I mean, we've talked a lot since I joined the podcast about how much I love Hofer and big fan of his. So I'm hopeful that that's a change permanent for him. But yeah, that 937 over the last 3 games, he came in after you know, Binnington was pulled in the Washington game, and though he gave up two more goals, he still looked pretty good in the second, in the back end of that game. So, you know, I know Hofer doesn't get a lot of back-to-backs, but, you know, maybe it's the same as the Kyrou thing that I pitched earlier. Maybe put Hofer back in the net against the Kraken.
Oh, boy. And I know you're speaking bold language right now. Yeah, I mean, he had that three-game stretch, 7 goals against Chicago, 3 goals against Utah before he was pulled after less than 8 minutes, and then the 5 goals in Pittsburgh, including the goals in the first 2 shots of the game, I believe
it
was.
Yeah, that was rough.
So those 3 games, 717 save percentage, 7.79 goals against average. And since that Pittsburgh game, he's had a start in Columbus, came in for Binnington in Washington, and then the shutout in Buffalo. So that's 3 games, 938 save percentage, 203 GAA. So I feel like you can kind of look at what he's done recently and put that bad stretch for him in the past. And that is a great sign for the Blues, because we've talked about a lot of the things that have gone wrong with St. Louis, but that's the biggest one. Like, the goaltending was the biggest one that has gone wrong. And if part of the tandem is fixed, so to speak, on the road back, you can feel a lot more confident about where they are. Now, Binnington, he's still got to find his own way. There were some games where he kept them in it. I think that Los Angeles game that went to overtime, he was a big reason why it was 1-1 after regulation. The Edmonton game that we talked about from Monday, it was 2-0, and it could have been 3 or 4-0 in the second period if he doesn't make some big saves and allows the team to get back in. So he's made some timely saves in some games, but the overall numbers just haven't been good enough. And if Hofer is at that point, the Blues can kind of hope that Binnington can get to that point next.
Yeah, it was, you know, getting so far into the season with the goalies looking that bad, you know, I'll be honest with you, I was kind of getting to a point where it's like, oh my gosh, are both of these guys broken? Like, is this fixable? You know, I was starting to think, is the coaching bad with the goaltenders? Is the game plan bad with the goaltenders? Yeah, you know, and I couldn't figure it out. Part of it's so much traffic in front of the net front. Part of it's bad bounces, right? But seeing Hofer take those steps this week has been, really encouraging for the team, but I think is going to be reinvigorating for the fan base going forward. And I think that's important. You know, it's one thing watching losses. You know, it'd be one thing if the Blues were, you know, 5-8-2, right? With, or what are they, 5-8-2 or 5-8-3? It's one thing to be 5-8-2 with, you know, 8-1 goal losses, but most of those losses, they've been just blown out. And that's demoralizing, not just for a fan base, but for a team. And, you know, I think, you know, you saw it with Hofer in the Washington game. You saw it with Binnington in the Edmonton game. You know, even if they do allow a couple of goals off the jump, once things stabilize, the rest of the team can get going. So I'm hoping that, you know, if they can be a stabilizing force more than just 2 periods a game like we saw in Edmonton, more like a full game like we saw in Buffalo, or to your point, that Calgary game that Hofer really stole for the Blues. They probably shouldn't have won that game. He won that game for them.
Yeah, and you're going to hear more later in our conversation with Mike McCurdy. He is the man behind HockeyViz.com, and we have a discussion about the types of goals that the Blues are letting in, and a discussion about tips and deflections and kind of the chanciness of those. So stay tuned for that. As far as Dalibor Dvorsky, he scores his first NHL goal, one-timer on the power play from the right flank. That's his spot. It was just such a fitting way for him to get that first goal.
It was pretty, wasn't it? I mean, you know, I just got to see him a couple of times last year, and it's, you know, in the preseason this year, it's hard to get to see these guys in the AHL, but man, that one timer was pretty. You know, as soon as he let it go, I knew it was in. It was just the most beautiful goal, and great shot, you know. And I think the amount of time he's getting on the ice, on the power play is a good indicator of how much trust he has, which is crazy, you know, considering he's 20 years old. But kid's got a heck of a shot, right?
Yeah, and that's what they wanted to use. I mean, this is what he's known for. He's an offensive guy. His shot is up there. It's a borderline elite shot, I would say, for I guess for his age. We'll see how it translates to the NHL, right? But the fact that he has that in his repertoire and the fact that he can kind of unleash a one-timer or a snapshot and challenge goalies from distance, that's a good weapon to have. Obviously, he does other things. He kind of sees the ice well. He protects the puck well. And for the first couple of games, he went in and faced his face-offs, and recently he's kind of dropped off a little bit. But overall, he's maybe showing right now a little bit that he deserves to stay up in the NHL. I think before this shakeup in Buffalo, you can kind of see where the pecking order is, right?
Right.
You see Texier is down on the bottom. He's been healthy scratched the most. When he plays the least. Walker was healthy scratch before Joseph was. And even, you know, beyond that, I mean, Sundqvist caught a health bomb yesterday. So there are guys that have been in and out of the lineup instead of Dvorsky. Like, the more guys that are healthy scratched in front of Dvorsky, the more you think about it. But in that same vein, it seems like anyone could be on the outside at any moment. So I do think that he's shown a decent amount to say, hey, I deserve to be here. But it's a matter of how the Blues kind of perform and what environment they want him in, I think.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, I was just talking about, right, like how some of those blowouts can demoralize a team and a fan base, and this could do the opposite, right? A young guy coming in, providing a spark, you know, he is exciting on his own, but he provides, or brings rather, a level of excitement to a team and a fan base. And I think you saw it, right, in that Edmonton game. They're down 2-0. They're clearly struggling, like you said. It felt like the kind of game that has gotten away from them, and very much felt like it was going to get away from them again. And then he nails that one timer, and all of a sudden things turn around. The Blues score the next two goals. They win the game.
It might have been the biggest goal of the season.
I agree. I mean, it was huge. And you know, the moment wasn't too big for this 20-year-old kid that we've heard about for so long. You know, when the time comes, and maybe it's not this year, right? But when the time comes that the Blues are true contenders again, having a shot like that is very exciting. You know, the future is bright. You know, and I think that the more that the Blues rely on him, the more he's going to grow, and the more he grows, it's going to provide more excitement. It might even provide some pressure for those guys like Kyrou and Thomas to step it up, because you've got a kid behind you ready to take your spot.
Yeah. Last topic at the net front. We're going to talk about Milan Lucic signing a professional tryout with Springfield in the AHL. Springfield has said they expect him to play tonight against Bridgeport. This will be his first game action in about a month. He had an interview in Springfield recently this week where he said he tore his groin in the preseason. Ooh. In St. Louis, and that was the injury they were working through. And I think it happened in the practice after that first game in Columbus, dating back to maybe, I think, September 22 or 23, something like that. He took some time off, maybe about a week, was back on the ice, played 3 preseason games. In total, he had 1 goal, 1 assist, and 4 preseason games with St. Louis. And now, after about a month off the ice, or month away from games, he's been skating on his own. Expected to be playing in a hockey game. And we'll see what ends up coming of this, but this is a lot of effort to put into a guy that you're not going to sign. To bring him in for training camp, to give him every opportunity in the games to earn a job, to rehab him for a month, and then to send him to the AHL, where they do have some injury issues that have popped up recently where they do need some bodies. But it is still taking ice time from someone. Right. So it is a lot of resources to put into someone that you're not going to sign. So that's why, in my mind, I've already considered him, kind of part of this Blues team when he is healthy and ready. Just what do you expect to see out of him when he's in the AHL for however long?
Yeah, so you know, I think you've hit the nail on the head. You know, you don't put these kind of resources into a guy unless you think he's going to make an impact for your team. So he clearly brings something to the table that Montgomery and the rest of the Blues feel like this team is missing. I would assume that's the physicality. I don't know how much else he can really, yeah, you know, realistically bring it. What is he, 37 years old?
He's, you know, 37. And you know what? I think it's the competitiveness, right? Because if you think that the effort on a night-to-night basis has been an issue for this Blues team, this is a guy who, that's kind of what he does, right? That's his thing, is bringing competitiveness and a little bit of snarl, some toughness. Maybe that drags guys into the fight. Now, 37, as we've talked about, he's already been hurt. So do you wonder about injuries the rest of the season? And then when he was playing in the league 2 years ago, it was just a brief stint in Boston before he got hurt. And then he ran into off-ice issues with a domestic abuse arrest, and ultimately the charges were dropped. So even during the time when he was in the NHL a few years ago, he wasn't all that effective. So we can think about the attributes that he brings, but in total, is he going to be someone that moves the needle for the Blues? I don't know.
I don't think he can be on the ice. Granted, it's just a couple of preseason games, but I hadn't seen enough from him to think that he was a needle mover, to your point. No, is he a locker room guy? Can he be a locker room guy and help these guys gel and kind of be the kind of guiding light that says, hey, look, you know, you guys got to have some fire, and he provides that spark for that fire. Maybe, you know, and it's relatively low stakes, right? Like, you know, this guy's not going to, they're not going to pay him $8 million a year for that. You know, it's going to be a small deal if it happens, right? It's going to be a small deal, and he's not going to see a lot of minutes, I would imagine. But in those minutes that he does see, I bet we see him flying around the ice, you know, and trying to be an example. Which he's kind of talked about a little bit, you know, in interviews, trying to get back into the game and trying to kind of rehab, not just himself, but his image a little bit, and wanting to be that kind of guy. So I think that there's maybe some value there in that. The biggest thing I would be concerned about, would be that you mentioned it directly, would be a 37-year-old guy taking ice time away, probably significant ice time eventually if they're trying to get into the NHL, away from a guy they could be developing in Springfield.
Yeah. So, Nathan, I think that's everything at the net front right now, but stay tuned for an interview with Micah McCurdy. As we mentioned, he is the man behind HockeyViz.com, and we talked about the Blues analytics this season. Why fans should or shouldn't care about him, where expected goals is good and where it kind of has holes. And we talked about, of course, the goalies, and if that gets fixed, what happens with the team moving forward. So for Nathan Mills, I'm Matt DeFrance. Stay tuned for the interview with Micah McCurdy. We'd like to welcome in Micah McCurdy. He is the founder and operator behind HockeyViz.com, one of the best analytics sites in the world regarding hockey. We're pleased to be joined by Micah right now to talk about the Blues and their season so far. So, Micah, welcome to NetFront Presence.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and so we were talking a little bit before we started recording about the chatter in St. Louis right now. A lot of the talk, as they've struggled through the opening part of the season, has been about their underlying numbers, including their coach basically saying, hey, if you look at our expected goals for, expected goals against, how we've kind of controlled that sort of play. If you look at what we've done, teams with that profile in the past have made the playoffs. And so with that in mind, I mean, Micah, what's kind of your general look at the Blues so far this season?
So first up, I think he's essentially right. It's by no means a guarantee that a team with the kinds of results that the Blues have had purely in terms of chances would necessarily make the playoffs. Certainly teams with that kind of chance record have missed the playoffs, but mostly they do make the playoffs. And then, but even just looking at XG itself, you have to be a little bit careful when you look at these kinds of comments. And of course, one of the things that makes the current landscape so complicated is that sort of everyone and their dog has an XG model of one kind or another, because everybody wants to try to quantify the value of chances, and different philosophies can make for something quite different. So the crucial detail, which really distinguishes what, if you're looking from one thing for another thing, is whether what you consider to be inside an XG model and what you consider to be after. And for me, at least, the most important things that come after XG, after chance quality itself, is shooter talent, finishing talent, and goaltending talent. And so you want to say that a shot that's being taken by Alex Ovechkin at a specific spot on the ice is the same shot as a shot that's being taken by any other player in the league. But you wouldn't want to say that those two shots, even if they're the same chance, they have the same sort of constructed quality, they don't have the same chance of actually going in the net, because one of those shooters is better. And similarly, if you have goaltenders who are weaker, then you'll have a higher goal chance without actually changing the XG itself. And so if you're looking at models that include, you know, goaltender positioning or not, you know, that's a philosophical fundamental difference, and sometimes they confusingly go by the same name. But with that said, sort of wading into all of that, the way that the Blues are generating chances is a little bit better than average. The way that they're preventing chances at 5-on-5 is also a little bit better than average. And both of those things might come as a surprise to Blues fans who are seeing that the goal totals on both sides of the puck are not that great. And so the real surprise, of course, is that they're finishing quite poorly so far this season. And the goaltending so far this season has been very, very bad, which you don't need an outside person to tell you.
Right. Yeah. I mean, right now we are recording this on Thursday morning. So the morning after the Blues were blown out 6-1 by the Capitals, and they've now lost 7 of 8. So, you know, Micah, we can kind of delve more into what you value in your expected goals model. But right now, like, I think a lot of Blues fans that have seen the chatter from myself, other writers, obviously the head coach we talked about earlier, and said, you know what, I don't really care what the expected goals look like. They've lost 7 of their last 8. So why should fans kind of care about the underlines right now when the results are so poor, so to speak?
So, I mean, on the one hand, I you know, my approach is extremely analytical, obviously, but I don't have any problem with any fans, you know, who want to like drink beer and yell at the TV for any reason. Like, there's no right or wrong way to be a fan. But the only what's interesting to me about the analysis, though, is that it provides you with some understanding of not exactly if your pain is going to go away, but if it's going to be turned into a different kind, or sort of what kinds of things you can expect in the future, whether they're good or bad. And so in particular, the goaltending situation, I think we're going to be talking about that a lot unavoidably, because I think that's what it keeps on coming back to.
Yeah.
Is one of those things where these kinds of bad runs, and of course, Binnington gets a lot of the attention because he's considerably more well-known, but Hofer has been every inch as bad as far, and that those kinds of poor goaltending performances for on this kind of length of time that we've had so far in the season, that amount of poor goaltending is, unfortunately, as hockey fans know pretty well, part and parcel with the way the sport is. That if your goaltender hits one of these rough patches in the playoffs, for instance, that's obviously worst of all, you know, you'll simply be turfed, whether or not your skaters are really good. You know, that's just the nature of the sport. And so that there's a sort of cruelty that's baked in there. But part of what makes the expected goals concept interesting to me is precisely that it lets you actually say sensibly if a raft of goals against is a skater problem primarily or a goalie problem primarily. And I think in this case, because it looks from the outside at least pretty clearly to be a primarily goaltender problem, then you have to look at the goaltender quality. And so for Binnington, of course, he had a bad year last year, but a great year the year before that. And his had an uneven career, sort of colored a little bit in people's eyes by, you know, international results. He's been a very high profile goaltender for a long time, but But no matter how you slice it, if this, the way he were performing this year so far, were somehow his new normal, that would be extremely surprising. And so, if you think that the goaltending issues are essentially just the run of poor form that any goalie can have, even a good one, then there's every reason to be optimistic, especially when you look, as Coach Montgomery was saying, at the chance details, as if you try to take the goaltenders out of it. And so it's not so much that the team has been playing well. Obviously, as a team, they have not, and then so they're losing. But have the skaters been doing some of what they should be doing? Absolutely. And so especially from a coaching perspective, I think that bodes well in a certain way. But on the other hand, then you have to worry about the more serious problems that, you know, maybe something serious has happened to one or both of the goaltenders.
Right. I mean, and as you mentioned, it was just 2 years ago where Bennington was legitimately one of the best 3 to 5 goalies in the league. Hofer was one of the 1 or 2 best rookie goalies in the league. I think him and Kochetkov could kind of battle for that title. And as a tandem, if you looked at their, you know, goals saved above expected just 2 years ago, they were up there with, you know, Winnipeg and Florida, and those were far less of tandems than St. Louis was, just in terms of start, your workload, I guess, for starters, right? So
sure.
With Bennington, I guess, in Hofer in particular right now, there's one type of shot that I'd like to just kind of talk to you about, which are tips and deflections. And this was something that Jim Montgomery also talked about before. He said, I don't think we've been beat. I don't think I've ever had a team be beat by more tips and deflections than this one has been so far. And right now, I'm looking at your data for Hofer and Bennington. Bennington's given up 7 goals on tips and deflections off of 2.9 expected goals, and Hofer's given up 4 goals off of 1.5 expected goals. So in aggregate, that's 11 goals against for 4.4 expected goals. Now, I think that's pretty bad. And a lot of us, I think, on the outside would look at it and say, well, you know, I don't know how much of a chance the goalie has on a tip or deflection. So it's hard to kind of pin that on a goalie. But clearly there's a value to those plays, right? So I guess the question is, like, how much of the goals allowed on tips and deflections do you think is the goaltender's form versus like a skater maybe having a bad run of bad luck in that particular area of the game?
Well, tips and deflections, I mean, the sport is a chancy sport, but even within that, it has chancier and less chancy portions. And part of why analytics nerds are constantly talking about chance rates is that they're so stable, that they're so indicative of skater talent. And because they're based on so many different people, they're based on so many different situations, so many minutes. Whereas when you cut into, you know, when you look at the goaltending, and then the goalie, of course, there's only 2 goalies in St. Louis so far this year, and then you look at specific shot types, and especially tips and deflections are the least controllable, both in the skater and in the shooter. And I mean, shooter's not even the word, right, for tips and deflections, but both the skating attackers and the goaltenders have the least control. It's the chanciest choice of offensive style, which is why people routinely say, you know, you shouldn't try to run an offense which is primarily based around tips. Like, nobody game planning for St. Louis would say, aha, boys, we got them now. All we need is a couple deflections and we'll be fine. Which is not to say that an experienced goaltending coach couldn't do something with that. In fact, part of why I started making those charts, you know, about how do goalies do on these shots, those shots, these kinds of shots, is that I wanted to see those spatial patterns, you know, tips and deflections, obviously right in front, but the other ones are more interesting. And then you can have something you can go with. Like the Blues last year, for instance, their offensive pattern showed a lot of goals, an unusual number of goals per shot from distance, especially from the left point. And so there you have something that looks like a strategy. We're like, okay, we have some sort of great ability to screen and some guys who can really find holes from the left-hand side. You know, that's something where you can game plan against. You can say, ha, this is what the Blues might do to us. But tips and deflections aren't the kind of thing where you can make a strategy around them, because you could generate 5 quote-unquote great tips and they would have you know, real good XG just based on historical averages. But because you're essentially rolling a dice there, I mean, all shots are a certain amount of rolling the dice, but tips and deflections are especially chancy that way. So the trouble, of course, with that line of thought is that luck is just luck, and there's no reason to think it's going to go anywhere. You know, it's sort of one of these things that just moves by itself. And so you can get hosed for an entire season, unpleasant as that might be to think about.
Yeah, and even past that, I think when I look at Binnington on Rister snapshots, 19 goals against on 16.2 expected goals, I can see, you know, kind of the red spots, the hotter spots at the left point. And I can think of myself two shots that came from the left point that deflected off a Blues player and into the net. So I don't know how that would be accounted in your model, whether that counts as a tip or deflection, or whether it's just a wrist snapshot that was deflected by an opponent. But I feel like that is also part of the same discussion that we're having right now too, like that element of going off your own teammate too.
So that's, I mean, track it is just whatever the NHL does, but I know from my own spot tracking that those kinds of tips and deflections, especially when they come off of a defending team player, routinely don't get annotated, don't get marked down.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes even when they do the shot locations, like there's data annoyances there, but they both have that same quality of what's an evidently largely random thing happening to shots where you don't expect to see, you know, no one is thinking, you know, that's great. We scored from the left point three times. We're gonna win tonight like that. You know, that's always the tell for whether something is or is not skill driven. Is can you imagine your coach describing it to your team players as the way that they intend to win? And if it sounds ridiculous, then it's probably luck.
And yeah, so I mean, I think the only team that I can't even say is a strategy for them, but that was kind of known for shot volume and point shots and getting traffic at the net would be like the San Jose, like the Pete DeBoer San Jose teams, when they had Brent Burns and Pavelski kind of doing that, and how much, you know, Pavelski really relied on point shots. I think that first year in Dallas, he kind of struggled a little bit more because he wasn't having that volume. He wasn't generating the tips and deflections and the rebounds that was basically kind of a strategy in San Jose. Like, I think we can see the numbers year after year and see them pretty much leading in shot attempts and see that there was some sort of strategy. But yeah, I don't think many teams are doing that on a regular basis across the league.
Well, that's the test, really, is, you know, someone says, well, you know, here's a way to score goals, or here's a way to prevent goals. And then you think to yourself, is that common? And then if your mind immediately goes to one team several years ago who had a specific pair of people who really, you know, worked, like, this is kind of like what I would tell people about the Sedins. I lived in Australia for a while when the Sedins were in their heyday. Uh-huh. And I would love to introduce, and the Canucks, of course, Vancouver was the only Canadian city that most Australians had heard of. And so when I was trying to sort of evangelize the sport a little bit or just make friends, I would say, you know, here's a pair of identical twins. And people would be like, oh, wow, is this common? And I would say, no, it's extraordinarily uncommon. No one plays like them, not even on their team. No one tries to copy them. It's impossible. Like, on the one hand, and so, like, you know, if you're trying to analyze the sport where you're trying to be, you know, disciplined and rigorous and doing everything the same way for every team, then that's fine. But you're going to come up against cases which are just not like the patterns that you're describing when you're describing a general pattern. And that's something that you also have to worry about too, where if you're trying to use expected goals, like, I think it's interesting and useful to talk about XG totals, even for single games, but for single shots, it can get lost in little noises here and there. You know, even when you want to come up with extra little details, like, you know, what do you do, for instance, what do you call the expected goals of the chance that went in the Minnesota overtime game the other night where the net was completely knocked off? The league itself didn't even list a shot type. Was that a wrist shot, a snapshot, a slap, you know, all the usual, they didn't even bother. They were just like, we don't know what that was, but it's a goal.
Yeah. First of all, which,
you do what you can.
Yeah. Right. Which part of Australia were you in?
Oh, in Sydney.
Okay, yeah, I spent some time in Fremantle on the West Coast over there. Loved Australia, and I think, you know, St. Louis has the only Australian in the lead right now. So good for Nathan Walker.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, it's funny that you talking about XG totals, because I think that I think XG could probably be in great need of a rebrand, so to speak. I think that players and eye test folks and analytics folks all speak the same language. They just, some of them don't know it. So that when coaches and players say we had a lot of grade A chances, that was a 10 bell save, we got goalied tonight, you know, they're saying the same thing in terms of that was a really high XG attempt there, or, you know, and the post game win expectancy was a lot higher than it turned out to be. Like, it's the same ideas, just in different clothing. And so I do think that, you know, sometimes, you know, we're all just speaking the same thing. It just comes out differently.
Yeah. The one thing that really opened my eyes about that is when I realized, when I saw after, you know, the 100th time you've seen the same post-game interviews, because athletes speak in this really restricted sort of set but if you're experienced and you sort of dig a little bit and you're good at sort of athlete speak, you can see what they're driving at. And when you hear for the 1,000th time, you know, when somebody says, oh, you know, you haven't had a goal in 25 games, how do you still keep going? And they just say, well, you know, I keep getting my chances and I know it's going to go in fine soon one of these days. Like they constantly say, you know, you're not really snake bit as long as you're still getting chances, which is exactly what the nerds are saying about XG. And in fact, this is Andrew Thomas, who used to run War on Ice. One of the mm-hmm. things I nicked from him is he said, you don't have to say XG. You can put that wherever you want. You can just say chances. Which is, after all, what it is you're trying to measure.
Right.
And so it's infuriating as a fan to be told, oh, you know, teams getting chances, they're just not going in, or, you know, they're not allowing that many chances. It's just that every chance is winding up in the back of the net. But the reason why athletes think of in those terms is because they have to cultivate the professionalism that's required to perform at that level. And so part of it is not even just, you know, oh, are you going to take a look at, you know, look up your stats on some website after a game? A lot of it is just, you know if those chances were good. You know, you just instinctively from playing know that, you know, the four shots you took, three of them were half decent chances and one of them was real good, you know, and you can use whatever words you want to describe that, or you can use numbers if you want to. But that intuition, the same way that sometimes I like to say that crowds are XG models that talk. Because when there's a good chance developing and everybody in the arena goes, what, you know, that's just them remembering what chances that looked like that looked like in the buildup. That's their own, the pattern matching of fans who know the sport. And so the mathematics adds a level of discipline, but it doesn't fundamentally change what you're talking about, which is just, are you getting good chances?
Right. And now, I mean, I think we can both agree that XG isn't perfect, right? I mean, if it was, I think everyone would have the same models at some point. Maybe not, but
yeah.
What are kind of the potential holes in it? I mean, from the outside, I can think about just lateral passes. I mean, that data is really hard to add in, I think. And then screens of goalies. Like, I don't know, maybe clear sight might have a little bit of that potentially, but I don't know many XG models that account for those two things. Like, where do you think holes are in just XG in general?
So just broadly, there's no shortage of holes in every serious endeavor. You know, anything you're really trying to, like, let's get a hold of, like, you know, you're trying to quantify something for over the entire league, you know, you're gonna you get something from being canonical, from putting everything in the kitchen sink in it. And a huge number of shots, you know, that weight of statistics is really, really good. But you also, the more you do that, the more you leave out. And it does actually, your question, your point about, like, you know, if it were perfect, they would all be the same. They would be different, and the differences between them would be less, but they would be more interesting because they would be about, you know, what do you really think is going on? Like, what do you really want to measure? And that would be like a sort of scholarly question. Yeah, or just what do you want to include? Like, for instance, your question about screens is a really good point. When I say we, I mean like people operating in the public using only what the NHL gives away for free,
right.
Which is, just for the record, considerable, like a lot more. People working in other leagues occasionally message me and they're like, how do you get this? And I'm like, I get it from the league. And they're like, my league doesn't give me that. And I say, well, maybe go ask them nicely. Like, people, you could do so much. Like, there's you'll hear nerds complain about, you'll hear people working in the space complain about the league all the time. And some of those complaints are valid, but I mean, they give us a huge amount of data essentially for free. But about screens, on the one hand, you could quantify that if you had, you know, really careful access to how tall is everybody, where are they standing, where are they looking. But the more carefully you incorporated all of that screen data, you know, you'd say, well, what was the point of that? Well, you'd say, well, if this guy was screened, then we don't want to ding him as a goalie for letting in these goals. After all, he can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
But being able to see around screens or not is a goalie skill.
Yep.
And some goalies do it better and others do it worse. And that's one of the angles. And so if you want goaltender skill inside your XG model, then that's great. Your XG is going to much more closely match what you see on the ice, but you've made it completely useless for evaluating your goaltender.
Sure. Yeah.
And so if you want to use the XG to evaluate your goaltender, then you need to keep all of the goalie things out. And then there's a matching story like that for shooter talent, for any kind of, you know, does a coach have a scheme where you're supposed to get open in a certain way because it's supposed to open up a specific seam pass, which is meant to lead to glorious chances? You know, maybe it is, and you put that in your XG model, and now you can't evaluate your coach anymore. So, except you have to do it in a different way. You have to do it in a different spot, more obliquely. You have to give them credit for the XG, not for the goals in excess of the XG. And so, but to sort of return to your more immediate question, like what are the holes? Screens for sure. One of the common ones that people say is pre-shot movement. Like, especially, you know, you take like a 2-on-1 as a really glorious example. That's not very well captured by current public models. Just because you don't know what is and what is not a 2-on-1. That, like, if a shot comes at the end of a 2-on-1, you don't know that working in the public space.
Right.
But of course, as a fan, you know that those shots are great. And so that's getting blended in with other stuff, with the shots that come from the same location or similar locations, but aren't from 2-on-1s, which are obviously not as good. And so it's not that you don't have all that stuff. Like, the data that you're training on contains all of those 2-on-1s and all of those shots that aren't, but you just don't have them distinguished. So you kind of have to lump them together. And so sometimes you say, well, it's going to be fine because it'll all even out. Other times you worry that it's not fine because it doesn't even out, because you see your team give up 4 2-on-1s in a game and you think, gosh, what a shame. So that pre-shot movement is definitely one aspect there. But then every shot has a certain amount of movement, right? People, like the days of people just cruising into the blue line and then putting a wrist or on net from the top of the circle, like, those days are long over, even if I enjoyed watching Jerome Iginla score like that a bunch when I was a kid. So anything that's sufficiently common is going to be only a partial hole at worst, if you see what I mean, because every goalie is going to have faced some stuff like that. Every team is going to be trying to create, you know, a few years ago, everybody was trying to make rush shots. A few years before that, everybody was trying to generate rebounds. You know, the league sort of moves in these big patterns where only one or two teams are like fighting against them, which is why people say it's a copycat league. So there's definitely holes, and I could probably rattle off 5 or 6 others where I'm like, you know, I wish I had that. I wish I could resolve that. I wish I had that extra little detail. But a huge amount of what makes chance quality what it really is backed not by sort of weirdness, but by physics, but by really basic stuff like takes longer for the puck to travel a longer distance, which is why the reaction time is tighter. So if you shoot from in closer, you're going to have a better chance. You know, that stuff is stuff that you could explain to a 4-year-old, and the XG model is not really doing anything interesting except the kind of boring computer work of, okay, how much easier is it to score if you move in how much closer, and like doing this sort of tedious measurements from all the parts of the rink, rather than actually sort of telling you anything interesting about hockey. It's really telling you something interesting about, or not even that interesting, just about how big the rink is. What are the angles? You know, a lot of it is sort of accounting in that sense, rather than something deeply interesting.
Yeah. And I feel like when you talk about the lead, kind of finding very popular ways to score, when you talk about rebounds and rush chances, I feel like now it's becoming more of a forechecking lead. And I think a lot of the data before was what X amount of goals are scored within 6 seconds of entering the zone, something along those lines. I don't know what, but I mean, a lot of teams, I think, in the copycat vein of the league, see what Florida does and say, oh, we have to dump a lot. Like, they're not playing a style that would have been recommended probably even like 5 years ago, with how much they dump the puck and how much they're able to forecheck and create chances off the forecheck.
Yeah, you definitely see that. You know, Carolina, for instance, was a team playing in that style five, mm-hmm. 6 years ago. Yep. And they were, and to some extent still are, pilloried as, despite, you know, however many wins, as a team that, you know, just had the puck all the time. Their shots are so ineffective. Because so many of their shots are not designed with a primary intent to score, but instead are sort of part of a sort of extended forecheck with the puck. And that, you know, and then you see Florida copy the style and with slight modifications, and then they win the cup twice and go to the finals three times in a row, you know, that kind of, and then all of a sudden people are like, oh no, we're going to do this like that. But those sorts of stylistic things are challenges on the one hand, but also they sort of save you a little bit from worrying, you know, oh, is this team doing something unusual? And you're like, well, it can't be too unusual given what the league is like.
Right. Now, Mike, I'm going to get you out on this one. We've talked a lot about XG in kind of the overarching manner of it. And we've said the Blues are above average on offense and they're above average on defense. Obviously, you have a lot of factors that go into your model, and I'm sure they have different weights. When you look at the Blues and what they've been able to do, I guess, in the offensive zone and then in the defensive zone, what of those factors are they doing the most or the best that have led to their above average expected goals totals?
So the difference at least offensively at 5-on-5, which is always sort of what I think about first, right, of all, yeah, as a point of discipline, I try to always think about 5-on-5 and sort of then move on to 5-on-4. But the hallmark that I was expecting from this year based on the roster talent from before is an ability to generate shots from the very center of the offensive zone, from the high slot. This is I think actually slightly an underrated spot, where if you have guys who can pick a corner, who can pick a not just necessarily a corner, but just like hit a small spot, then that area of the rink is really good, because you can't help holes appearing. Now, you simply can't cover the whole net, right, when you get a straight on look. You know, if you're working at a tight angle, then you can give the shooter very little to shoot at. And so that part has been essentially confirmed, that they're still generating a quite a bit more than a league average team would from the center of the high slot. But the extra detail that they're doing well that I did not expect is they're getting a little bit more from the net front. Not from the low slot, not from the mid slot very much, but from immediately in front of the net. They're generating some rebounds, getting it off of right point shots mostly, some left half wall stuff too. And that, if some of those shots start going in, which they mostly haven't so far this season, then I'm sure Montgomery specifically, but also Blues fans generally, will feel a certain kind of vindication there. You can run into problems even there too, right? Like, net front shots are obviously great, but you know, if you're sort of just jamming 2 feet ineffectively into a goaltender's pads, you know, that's not actually super threatening, even though it's super close. So you'd want to dig into some video to like look at that and say, you know, is that really like what I think it is, which is a good strategy that hasn't paid off yet, or is it an illusion? And so you always, like, you can, no matter your strategies, you can always go deeper. You can start with video and then add numbers and then add this and add that and add experts of whatever kind. And so But I always find that the deeper I get into any specific aspect of any team, the more I think to myself, okay, now I need, you know, to talk to a coach or to break down a bunch of video and see if that's really working.
Sure.
The other aspect on defense that I thought was good is the in the last year, there was a much better ability to keep, not so much to the outside, but to keep shots to the circles and not from the slot. And this year, it's not been quite so strong that way. You still see some good defensive zone work where there's no particular spots where you're getting lots and lots of shots accumulating, but you're not seeing that sort of cleanness in the slot that that makes your goaltenders look good, among other things. And so if specifically the goaltenders are expecting a particular pattern of shots that they're not getting, that they haven't yet adjusted to, that could be a serious source of problems, even while it looks good on paper.
Right. Well, Micah, I appreciate the time this morning. It was a great chat. I love chatting with you about this. And for the listeners out there, you can subscribe to Micah's work at hockeyviz.com. or follow him on Twitter at ineffectivemass. So, Micah, thank you for stopping by and appreciate the time.
No problem.
For Nathan Mills, I'm Matt DeFrance, and this was NetFront Presence.